What's going on, my beautiful people? Another great day here inside the Black Actor Studio. I'm your host, Danny Royce, and today we're going behind the camera. We have some very special guests today, two guests, so stay tuned.
You're tuned into Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Tune in right now.
Hey, it's Thursday. You know what that means. We are here inside the Black Actor Studio. Thanks so much for joining me, guys. This is 11 weeks. Crazy. 11 weeks gone by so quick. I have two awesome guests for inside the studio today. They are producers and have a huge initiative in South Africa. Can't wait to talk about it. Dexter Davis and James Few. Their credits are a lot. There's a lot of credits. There's Blue Meridius, I'm sorry, starring Anthony Mackie, and Team Joy, starring Jesse Williams. Tongue-tied there. But thank you so much. Black Actors Studio is very proud to welcome both Dexter Davis and James Few. What's going on, guys?
Thanks for having us, Danny.
Oh, my pleasure. How are we doing today?
I'm good. How about you? It's Los Angeles, and you know, the weather's great, as usual.
Yeah, as usual.
So it's always great to be in town. So we're having a good time, and we partied a little bit too hard last night. So if this drags on, that's what we can
do. No worries. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great.
You know, we typically have actors on the show, but I like to show the audience and give them a perspective from all different areas in the film industry, because I think it's very important. So I like to start off each interview from the beginning. Where were you born, Dexter?
So I was born in Greenville, Mississippi. The Delta, and but I was raised from age 3 in San Jose, California.
Okay, and how about you, James?
ATL, Atlanta, Georgia, which is maybe the Black Mecca,
right? Black Hollywood is what they're calling it now.
Yeah. You don't get excited about San Jose.
Was it? I didn't. I'm sorry. Sorry, don't have no connection in Austin.
Right.
No, San Jose is beautiful. I have been there before. But this is our first time having two guests on in a panel in the studio today, so I'm excited. I'm going to be throwing back and forth a lot tonight. So tell us a little bit about your relationship with your parents, actually, growing up.
Well, it was good. I mean, I'm very fortunate that, I had parents who loved me and supported me and, always was intent on, advancing what it was I wanted to do in life. My mom and dad divorced when I was a young kid, but they maintained a relationship. And so I had both my mom and my father have an influence in my life. I have 5 other brothers, so there's a baseball team.
Five players.
Wrong sport.
See, that's how much I know sports. I thought I got away with this.
He almost let you go with it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, dorky guy. No. No, but it was good. I mean, my parents were Southern people who wanted a better life for their children, and like a lot of African Americans from the South went west and hopes for, better dreams for their kids and for themselves. And so, yeah, I have a sort of very, I would say, normal upbringing, but very supportive, very safe, there's no real tragic story to make it sound better.
We don't need tragedy.
You know what I mean?
That's good. That's awesome.
And we were, we never forgot where we came from, and, Mississippi and Greenville is very close to our hearts. That's where my father went back there, and all of my relatives, for the most part, live in the South. And so I consider myself a Southern guy.
Okay, both Southerns has some Southern hospitality going on there. So James, do you see a difference, obviously, but what is it to you, mean to you, the difference in Atlanta when you were coming up and now?
Oh man, so Atlanta, when I was coming up, we have this thing now, people that were like born in Atlanta, grew up in Atlanta that aren't transplants. We always talk about the old Atlanta. That's like a thing now. What's old Atlanta and new Atlanta? And I think, old Atlanta before Olympics, I like to say before 96, I mean, it was basically Atlanta was a town that grew into, I think, a big city. It was never this plan to be this big metropolis. But I think, you know, as investment came in after the Olympics, of course, the boom years, early 2000s, I mean, the city just grew up.
Right.
I mean, blew up. But as far as culture, and especially black culture, we also have a thing that we say Atlanta influences everything.
Mm.
You know, that's from music to film, business, entrepreneurship.
Right.
I love the city. I mean, that's where I'm from. It's, you know, we have a lot of new guests that I like to say, you know, with people moving in from, you know, all over the world, basically.
Right.
And it's added to the flavor, but, you know, the Southern hospitality, for the most part, is still there. And you just have, you know, really progressive, especially the black entrepreneurial and the film entertainment community doing big things.
Right. That's awesome. Creating more opportunities, right?
Definitely.
Did you have any nicknames growing up?
well, yeah, I mean, it's not embarrassing or anything. So my middle name is Robert,
okay.
And family just called me Robbie, but only family.
Robbie?
Yeah, Robbie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, how about you?
I can't say.
You can't say it?
Yeah. I really can't say, no.
So you had five other siblings, and how many siblings did you have?
Only child.
Their only child, wow. So how was that for you in that dynamic? And when did you feel like, when did you really get into, like, filmography, filmmaking?
So being the only child, let me give a little backstory about my mom and dad. And I think, I didn't know it then, but they were the perfect parents and had the perfect lives to prepare me for being a producer. And I didn't realize that until, you know, my late 20s when I started, you know, in the film business. But my father is an artist. So he's a right brain guy, very creative. He does sculptures. So I grew up around the arts. He would do art shows around the country, the black arts festivals. My mother, she always had aspirations and dreams of being an actress and going into theater. But growing up in a small town in the middle of North Carolina, you know, her dad was like, no, that, you know, you're not going to be an actress.
Right.
So she ended up majoring in literature. Went on to teach and also became an executive with Delta Airlines. So she also, you know, had dreams of the arts, but she was also a linear thinker and she could handle, you know, handle business.
Gotcha.
And so it was a perfect mix, like as far as the structure that, you know, producing needs. You know, I was growing up with my mom, you know, and understanding that and learning and seeing how she communicated with an artist, which is my father.
Right.
And so a lot of those skills I was just, you know, picking up naturally. And so now, you know, being able to work in the arts, work in entertainment, communicate, you know, a creative vision and understand how the numbers, logistics and all of that piece works. I credit that to them, and I didn't know it until I started doing it.
Oh, that's crazy. You have that whole dynamic going on in your own house. Just learning from it. That's awesome. And Dexter, when you were growing up, and what type of shows, specifically people of color, did you gravitate to or you aspired to work with in film?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about television, so is the you know, the classics.
Yeah.
And for me, the classes were Good Times.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, nice. The Jeffersons. All in the Family was like my all-time favorite. I really love the dynamic between Carol O'Connor and was it Shermley? What's the guy that played George?
Hemsley.
Yeah, Shermley. But I think that was probably most influential for me was Dynasty.
Of course. Nice.
Only because the Diane Carroll character, Dominique
Devereaux. Yeah.
Right. And she was like a badass.
She was bad.
Like Alexis. Like, I was like,
bad.
She's powerful, like a business person.
Right.
And like, I wanted to be her without being her, right, obviously. No Bill Mackey. Was that the designer's Bill Blass.
I think it's Bill Blass.
Yeah,
that was Bill Blass.
So, no, but, like, in terms of a kid, like, watching in the 80s television and looking at powerful African-American characters that affected in terms of how I thought about myself. And it was always people like in powerful roles and positions. you know, obviously the Cosbys, and seeing a doctor or a family that was, you know, the head of his family, but in a powerful kind of position.
Right.
So I was really drawn to those types of characters. But, you know, we watched everything, and I think that was important in terms of how I do my job today and the kind of stories that I want to tell. So they're not just sort of one-dimensional or specific to one group. It's just about really good storytelling. And hopefully, as a producer and as an African-American producer, it's my responsibility to make sure that there are black characters that are strong and powerful and are advancing the narrative about, you know, who we are and how we see ourselves.
Right.
And so I think it's part of my job is to not necessarily be the black producer, but be the producer that are giving, you know, all people's opportunity, but particularly people of color who don't always get the opportunities to do the kind of roles that they're, you know, that our counterparts sometimes do, or most of the time.
Most of the time,
do. But also from an executive, you know, from behind the scenes as well. So, you know, it's we don't see ourselves as a black company. I mean, obviously we're black,
right?
But in terms of really going outside of our borders, I think that we have to look at stories as a whole, and whatever they are, we're behind the scenes, so there's already this connotation that there is a black element, right? And that's fine, but we want to make sure that we are being responsible, because I think that's really important in black Hollywood,
right?
That if you're making it, you bring other people along with you.
Right. Right. I'm interested, I'm curious to know how you guys felt during the whole, you know, Bill Cosby, then there was like, then R. Kelly, then it was Jussie Smollett. It was just like so much back to back to back. How were you affected just seeing someone like Cosby on that?
I mean, and I'll let you speak to this as well, but look, I think, you know, when people do awful bad things, if they're proven to do awful bad things, they should be punished for that. You know, I think the African-American community is very forgiving, and we tend to really defend those people who we sort of look to as heroes, right? And we want to think the best of everybody, and right. I certainly do. So you really do shake your head in sort of disappointment, because you're like, no, not you, right?
Right, right.
Like, you know, you have made history and you stood for something in our community. And to see that, you know, diminished in whatever capacity that it has been is a sad thing. But at the same time, people should be held accountable for things that they've done if they are guilty, in fact.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, same thing. If you are proven to have done something wrong, you know, you should definitely be held accountable. What I think Cosby, you know, meant for the community and what he represented on TV is definitely diminished by, you know, what he, you know, is charged for.
Right.
But, you know, I was looking at, you know, Cosby in a Different World last weekend on, I think it's Hulu or somewhere that's streaming it. And, I mean, those positive examples are still great to see.
Right.
You know, when I was looking at it, you know, I didn't, you know, I wasn't thinking about what Bill Cosby was recently charged for, even though he should be held accountable. But seeing the message on television, I think it still, you know, holds a lot of weight.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I think it's something that, you know, still needs to be shown, you know, obviously, but people are, you know, are against that. But I want to get into, like, how you two met each other and grew this company. So let's start with Dexter. What were the first steps in, like, saying, okay, I'm going to do this, and this is how I'm going to do it?
I think I just wanted to implement certain previous successful companies. I wanted to not implement as much as... what is the word when you want to be like?
Replicate.
Thank you.
James is coming in with everything. Let's go. Coming in with names, words. Okay, thank you.
No, there were companies like that you probably don't know of, Polygram Film Entertainment, which was a Dutch company started by Philips Electronics, which is a Dutch company. So sort of like Sony did with Sony Music and Sony Films. So in the 90s, they had a music Polygram Music was very well known.
Okay, that's what I know.
And the CEO in mid 90s thought they should be in the film business, and they were really giving Hollywood a run for its money. Mm. So here's a Dutch company, Polygram Film Entertainment, that were, you know, winning Oscars and having a lot of success at the box office with films like Notting Hill and 4 Acres and a Funeral. Not 4 Acres. That's, you know, the spike.
Yeah, that's right.
Four funerals and like a wedding. And a wedding. Yeah. The Bridget Jones Diary, Walking the Dead, Shallow Grave, the Danny Boyle films, I can't think of the name of the film right now. But they were having these great successes, and they were basically taking the Hollywood model and from the UK, because that's mm-hmm. what they set up the shop, and they were creating a studio system within this organization. They were very successful at it, and even distributing films in the United States, and for a foreign entity, that really wasn't normal.
Right.
There's not a lot of foreign film companies that are distributing content in the United States, and so I just wanted to be Polygram. Mm. And had that in my head for a very long time, and thought in order for me to sort of try to become a company like that without $100 million, you know, to start, I need to go and learn about the international film business. And so that's how I ended up in Europe for 10 years, mm. just learning about, you know, how films are put together. And once I did that and had a deal with VW to promote foreign language films as a distributor in the U.S., I then left Berlin, because I was living in Berlin at the time, and moved to New York and set up shop, and mm-hmm. sort of have been doing it ever since.
Wow. Okay. James?
I think the original question, you asked how we met, and then I can kind of then throw it back to Dexter to segue to kind of how we're going about scaling and growing the company. But, you know, Dexter is actually... it's probably the person who introduced me to the business. So just a little backstory on what I was doing before this. I was a finance guy, so I started off in finance, got an MBA, worked in, you know, Wall Street consulting, you know, internal corporate development teams. Recession hit, I lost the job. Mm-hmm. You know, that was late 2000s. I think that was 2008. Mm-hmm. So lose the job with everyone else that was in finance.
Right.
Ended up at was on unemployment, and my unemployment officer told me, oh yeah, there's a new hotel, the W Hotel is opening up in Atlanta. Why don't you go by and check out and see what they have going on as far as positions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, me, I'm a big shot MBA. I've been working in high finance all of these years, and, you know, close to a six-figure salary at that time. And so I get to the interview, and he's like, yeah, we have front desk, concierge, room service. And
these are low paced,
you know, and nothing, you know, nothing against
right.
those jobs, but it was definitely night and day from, you know,
for
what
sure.
I've been doing.
For sure.
But the GM was a really cool guy from New Zealand. He's like, man, you're great. You know, I would love to have you. I mean, you could, you know, on that concierge desk. And I was just like, man, what the hell? I'm not doing anything. But very quickly, you know, one of my favorite quotes from MLK, and I'm kind of paraphrasing it. Uh-huh. It's, you know, no matter what you're doing, if you're a sweet streeper,
yeah.
you sweep that street better than anyone has ever swept the street before, right? Mm-hmm. And so the same thing, you know, applies to, you know, whatever job, right? So I'm at the concierge desk for 3 months. I was quickly promoted to the VIP manager of the entire hotel. And so at that position, you know, just talking and meeting people, and I would talk to the executives about the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and then I would talk to guys who were coming in to party about where they need to be in Atlanta to have a good time. Mm-hmm. So just, I guess, the diversity of my background
right.
helped in that position. So long story short, I end up getting written up in Atlanta magazine. I think Dexter read that magazine. He was in town with his company for the, I think it was the 40th anniversary of Alvin Ailey.
The 50th anniversary.
50th of Alvin Ailey Dance Theater.
Okay, okay.
So he was, I think, throwing the...
I was hosting the party.
Hosting the after party. Mm-hmm. His PR person, I got an invitation from his PR person. I show up at the party, you know, party's about to end. I finally meet Dexter. I said, oh, okay, cool. We started. You know, send a thank you email maybe the next day. Great party. You know, love to sit down for lunch, talk about more about what you do. And then from there, you know, kind of the rest is history.
Right.
But, you know, we started off on a consulting basis, you know, running different financial models for how his films were being released with D-Street Releasing. So mm-hmm. taking some of my, you know, expertise from the finance days, applying that to how films are platformed, looking at different comps
nice.
Of the films that, you know, we were thinking about acquiring and what those look like from a financial perspective. He said, oh, you may be good at this. You ever have you ever thought about film? Like, yeah, of course. But, you know,
I'm working as a producer.
As a producer, okay.
But in Atlanta, at that time, now Atlanta is known as, you know, the second Hollywood, right? But back then, I think the tax credits or film incentives were just starting, and mm-hmm. it was just Housewives
and reality TV
at that point. So the exposure 10 years ago is night and day to what it is now. But, yeah, so, I mean, that's how it started. Went out to Cannes. Helped acquire some films,
nice.
And I came back to Atlanta, put in my 2 weeks notice, and haven't looked back since.
Nice. Ken will do that too.
Yeah, Ken, right.
Ken Film Festival, like that's it.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. Have you been?
Amazing. No, I haven't been, but I had a film to go to it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's short film, which is an honor.
Okay, yeah. And I think that's how we met Ryan. Right?
Yeah, Ryan Coogler.
Oh, right. Yeah, cool. Okay,
when he had his short film there
in
2009.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we met him at the Amfar party?
No, we met him before the Amfar party.
We did?
So Rhonda met him and she said, you need to go check out this guy's short film.
Okay.
And we looked at his film and he came to lunch with us. We
I thought that was. Yeah, I drink too much rosé.
Yeah, you got a lot.
Because I have like a whole different like memory about. I only thought we met him at the party because you know there was like three black people,
right?
And me, James, 50 Cent, but he didn't want to sit with us.
Yeah, in Toronto.
He's like, no, I'm not sitting with you. 50 Cent, really?
The Toronto Film Festival. He was
We were with. Yeah. We were sitting at the. So Amfar is this, you know, big.
Yeah.
You know, research HIV and AIDS research.
Yeah.
And so Amfar is like the Oscars of the festival, mm-hmm. right? It's like it's a big fundraiser, and I think when it first began, I mean Elizabeth Taylor was a chair, and whatnot. So over the years, I would go to the Amfar event, which was like the you know the place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that year President Clinton was hosting.
Yep,
wasn't he?
Wow. Yeah.
So James, myself. Cameron Bailey, who was the head of the Toronto Film Festival, who's also a black man.
Okay.
And so 50 Cent was supposed to be at that table, and I don't know if I should be telling this story, but he... But
you're anyway, already doing this, so let's go.
Yeah, no, he came by, and he's like, this is a black table, and like left. And we're like, what? It's not like we're like... The help.
Oh, right.
Like we were sitting with Eric Eisner, Michael Eisner's son, you know what I mean? We're like in good company. He's like, this is a black table. Like, oh, okay.
Wow.
See you later.
I'm interested to know who are some of the people that you would like to work with in the future? Producers, directors, what have you.
God, man. That's what I never thought about.
Really? Okay.
Is that terrible?
No, I mean, some people do, some people don't.
Yeah, I just, producer, directors, you know, there's so many people that
talent.
Well, I mean, you kind of want to work with anybody who's good and, you know, and doing something. So it's very, you know, hard to say just who. I'll tell you something. I was reading a script the other day.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, this is perfect for Jean Smart. I don't know if you know who Jean Smart
is. Yes, yes.
From Designing Women. Uh-huh. But I have always wanted to work with Jean Smart. Well, I do not know why I want to work with Jean Smart.
This is perfect for Jean.
Jean Smart, if you're out there.
Right, if you're listening to
if
this.
If you're listening to this, I want to work with you. But really, outside of that, I mean, you know, look, there are terrific actors and so much talent out there. So it feels like it would be... not right of me to say just, you know, specifically one person, although I just said Jean Smart.
Right. What about you, Dan?
You know, it's funny you ask. We were just talking about it yesterday, and I was on the plane, and I just saw Green Book. on the plane. And Mahershala. Awesome,
thanks a lot, James. I couldn't think of it.
And you couldn't think of it. Yeah, Mahershala Ali. Yes. I mean, just that role, but I've kind of been a fan of that brother for a while.
Yeah, and, for sure.
And I just love him on camera and just his energy, like style, like all the way around. He just, like, once he's on screen, it's like you can't stop.
Right.
Like watching him, and I think he's really authentic. So yeah. I mean, that's just someone recently. When I was looking at him, I was like, I would love to, you know, to work with him.
That'd be
dope. I know someone who we wanted to work with. It was Jesse Williams. Someone who I actually was like, I really want to work with this person.
Yeah, yeah.
And so during his BET Humanitarian Award, he was the recipient.
Right.
And I don't know if you saw that speech.
I did.
That speech was pretty incredible. It was a huge speech. And I remember I was visiting my mother, and we were all watching together, and I remember thinking, God, I would one day want to work with him, because what he's saying just resonated and spoke to me, and I thought, man, if the black community could really hear what he's saying mm-hmm. and never forget it, it would do something for the community.
Right.
Because that kind of empowerment, self-awareness, caution in terms of, you know, how we spend our money, where we spend our money.
Yeah.
He was just speaking, you know, to
truth.
The truth to what was going on in society. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I have not heard any person of, you know, any kind of notoriety say something that I thought was so bold.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I would say that it's not just about the talent. It's also about the activism and what, you know, black folks are bringing to the table in terms of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a platform like Jesse Williams and others, and you are making an effort to make change, I think that is something to really look up to and aspire to work with.
For sure. Mm-hmm. And so tell us, it's a good segue to Team Joy.
Yes.
Tell us about that project.
So a few years ago, I developed this project and ended up sort of passing it on to the director-writer who had the script and that I was helping to develop, because
mm-hmm.
I had so much on my plate. And so last year, he asked me if I would get back involved with the project, and I said, yes, I will, if the character that is written as a lead be changed to a black character or mm-hmm. a black person. And because I knew I had Jesse on the brain for that project, and when he agreed to do that, I said, "Okay, great, let's just do that." So the story is about a father-daughter, young 14-year-old girl, who are basically like con artists or mm-hmm. a confidence. What is it called? Confidence man? Is that the phrase?
Con man. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but is it like, you know, if you do a confidence game, it's like you're trying to swindle somebody.
Okay.
So they have this thing, and so there was a film called I think Under the Paper Moon, which was a Ryan O'Neill film a long time ago. So it was sort of similar to that. But basically, they're going around to survive doing con artist games or whatever. I don't know what you call
it.
scamming people. Yeah. And so I just, it's great in that you don't see, you know, it's a film that with a black character that's not black, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not, it's nothing other than, you know, these two people who are trying to get through life, who had, you know, sort of tragic background, backstory. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's being directed by Joe Trepichin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an American living in Brazil. We have another project with him, another Brazilian project with him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a, you know, smallish film. I think it's the budget's like, you know, under $3 million, and
just under $3 million, no big deal.
Well, I mean, by Hollywood standards, no, that's not a big deal. And so we're doing that with him at the. Hopefully this fall, when all the financing is finally put together, and we're going to shoot that in Atlanta.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's awesome. What are some of the challenges, James, that you run to in production? I know there are mm-hmm. quite a bit. Just touch on a couple. Just because we do have viewers who are aspiring producers,
mm-hmm.
Directors, things like that. So a little insight of things to look out for.
I guess you can ask that question, like what part of the production process, but, you know, if we're talking about physical production. Mm-hmm. You know, if we have some, you know, some indie filmmakers listening, you know, when I have to go back to my, you know, business roots and finance background, mm-hmm. you know, and that's kind of how I was introduced to the business and kind of what I was kind of known for before I kind of segued into more, you know, producing and developing. But I would say, you know, you have to be really stringent with your budget and set up, you know, financial controls. That's whether you're spending $1,000 student film. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to say if you can't manage $1,000, you're not going to manage $10, you're not going to manage $100.
Right.
You won't manage $1,000,000. But if you can manage $10,000, you can manage $10 million. It's mm-hmm. the same. But, you know, it's production gets a little bit bigger, but it's all about, you know, great department heads, open communication, and really spending the time on the front end. Mm-hmm. You're never going to get, you know, you're never going to, you know, solve all the problems, because in production, as everyone knows that's listening, something comes up every day. But with great communication, great teamwork, it's like a lot of that stuff, you know, you can solve those problems.
Right.
I mean, every production that I've been on, it's a problem solving exercise.
Yeah.
Whether it's going to be, you know, big or small, but, you know, you're going to have a problem that you're going to have to solve. And because filmmaking is such a collaborative process,
yeah.
It's really important to, you know, work with good people and good, honest people. So I would say whether, you know, you're a filmmaker that's just starting or you've been doing it for, you know, 20 years, I think, you know, looking out, you know, those three, you know, tiers are very important.
Okay, for sure. Dexter, looking for talent, because obviously producers have the last say, mm-hmm. right? Have you ever had to, like, say, no, I'm not filling the person? Like, do you have casting directors that work for you, or do you cast your own films?
So I have casting directors that work for me, okay. that work with me. But I tend to do my own casting.
Okay.
So I'm like, can you just call the agents for this guy or uh-huh. that girl? You know, I feel like casting is kind of a art form.
Mm.
And you would think that everyone, it's self-explanatory, or that, you know that you have this particular character and they're XYZ, but then you have someone who just totally doesn't fit that from an actor's point of view, and they don't look like the part, or they don't, and their, you know, everyday life behave that way, mm-hmm. or you've never seen them in a part like that. So I think casting is obviously one of the most important aspects of getting the film together and getting it right.
Yeah.
And so it's just an instinct that you have. And so I tend to not just go off of what casting directors suggest.
Right.
Obviously, I take that into account. But it really is a gut feeling that I have about a character, and because I watch a lot of movies, because I watch a lot of television to see who's out there, and, you know, it's, if, you know, I don't understand filmmakers who don't watch
right.
films or yeah. watch television. You know what I mean? It's astonishing.
Right.
But the more that you the broader broad approach to film and television in terms of, as a viewer, is very important in terms of how I do my job,
mm.
because I'm actually exposed to a lot more talent than I would normally be. And so
right.
I'm looking at talent from all over the world and thinking, okay, you know, they will fit in this film, and I don't care if they're from Germany or from France or from Brazil, if it makes sense.
Mm.
Because I also think that outside of just plucking the A-listers who can get you financing or distribution, is really important as producers that we're in the star creating business, so that,
I like,
you know,
that
we can nurture and foster that talent, so that when they come back and work with us again, we're helping them build a name for themselves,
right?
Right. And in today's atmosphere, you really need those names to sell internationally, especially.
For sure, for sure. And what's like one thing that you look for in talent when you do casting?
Yeah, I think
it's... Is it more of just like, I can see it when I see it?
Yeah, it's that whole thing about having it,
mm-hmm.
which you can't really, you know, put your finger on,
right.
but you know it when you see it,
yeah.
and you hear it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this, you know, like a ton of bricks comes over, and you're like, yeah, that that person has something.
Gotcha.
And you can't define it by any sort of definition that, you know, someone has characterized it. A person that has it has this.
Yeah. Right? Right, right.
We don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. It's just something when they walk in the door, you're like, whoa, yeah. Right? And you see that on the screen. I've done that. I mean, I've done that where I'm like, I'm watching something. I'm like, oh, my God, I love that person. Let's call their agent to see what they're doing and blah, blah, blah. And so it's, for me, it's as simple as that.
Okay. And I know we touched on it, well, earlier before the show, but I want to talk about Black Hollywood because it's this conception that, you know, or perception that, you know, Black Hollywood back then, you know, when Denzel and all that was running it. And then, so it's like this division of Hollywood and Black Hollywood, which sometimes I don't really get it, but also I want to get your input. So I'll start with you, James, about how Hollywood has changed, quote unquote, Black Hollywood, yeah. And your approach to that.
I mean, I think for so long, a lot of our stories were just not told, and we're just so underrepresented for so long. You know, if you just go back all the way to the beginning, I mean, there were no roles. You know, first we were, you know, the help, and we were a lot of buffoonery and like just. You know, the only roles that, you know, we...
Lots of crackheads.
Lots of crackheads.
Yeah.
So.
they went into crackheads, then went into the gangster movies.
Yep.
And, once I think Hollywood saw something that they thought worked for us, that's all that was produced or that came out. And I think recently, you know, we're starting to see, you know, it's definitely opening up, you know, from the TV and the film, which is a good thing. You know, I look at, you know, what... You know, Ava, you know, Lena Waithe has been able to do. Of course, you know, Charles King at Macro, you know, Tyler Perry.
Yeah.
you know, he's created his own world. You know, and even, you know, Will Packer. I mean, you have, you know, you have a lot of big names now that are definitely getting more of us in front of the camera.
Right.
Behind the camera, I think, is still, that's another issue.
Bit of a deficit, I would say.
Yeah. But, you know, that's, you know, definitely something that, you know, both Dexter and I are adamant on changing and developing, you know, producers and other behind the camera as well. But, you know, I think for so long we weren't there. You know, now, you know, we're getting, you know, a few big names that are pushing us out there. You know, and Dexter and I were having this conversation yesterday. It's great. What does it really mean if you look at it a little bit deeper? On the independent side, for people who are really, you know, controlling their own destiny and their own fate, I think that number is even smaller of Black filmmakers and I guess, and Black influencers that are pushing the envelope. But when you think about, you know, independent producers or independents that are green lighting and financing, you know, that's the real story. I think that's not being told as much, and there's not as many of us doing that.
Right, for sure. I know you had a whole tweet about it.
It was a kind of an angry tweet.
Yeah,
you know, and I think it was geared towards some cat who was a professor at UCLA or something. And I was just like, and he was talking about Black Hollywood, and I was like, well, what is Black Hollywood? Is that Black people living in Hollywood? Because, you know, Hollywood for me is this giant, right?
Yeah.
It's this giant, massive machine. And it ain't controlled by people who look like us, right? And so with all the successes of the people who James just mentioned, and, you know, obviously there's some exceptions there. I think Tyler Perry is one of them in terms of producing his own content and controlling that, but not controlling the distribution. So for me, when I think we deserve the title of Black Hollywood when we own stuff, right? It's not a better word to use for that, but I don't know how, you know, is it X-rated show?
No, no, I think good.
R-rated, not X-rated. See where my mind is. Right? no, but it's, we don't own shit.
Right.
And no matter how successful we become within the industry, we're still bound by the fact that we can't make decisions for the most part.
Yeah.
Independently, you know, and what we are set out to do is to, you know, further create this company where not only are we controlling the content, we also can control the distribution, and we can find and develop financing outside of the studio system, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think that's where the real power lies. And so we're not really just depending on Hollywood or the U.S. We work outside of the U.S. So because we understand that there is, you know, financing outside of America, right, that a lot of African Americans have no, you know, concept of.
Right.
And so a lot of the pictures that we have in development that were, you know, future productions are done outside of the U.S. for the purpose of being able to finance them mm-hmm. a lot easier than we would in North America. And then the upside of that is that we really are in control of the narrative and really don't have to, you know, ask for permission right. to tell our stories or whatever stories we want to tell. Mm-hmm. And in the event that, you know, a distributor in the U.S. doesn't want to buy it, guess what? We have the apparatus that we can distribute it ourselves and know how to also sell it and distribute it worldwide. Mm-hmm. And that is what is lacking within our community, is the understanding of how the business really works.
Right.
You know, I remember the first time I went to Cannes was 20 years ago. And you can count on one hand how many African Americans you would see at the festival, but also at the marché, which is the market.
Yeah.
And so I had a very, very early introduction to the business of film and television. And so we're taking that and really basically creating a studio model, mm-hmm. but as an independent, so that we're never really dependent. And we get to say whatever the F we want to say, right? And no one's going to, you know, put any kind
of censorship
or whatnot on telling the stories we want to tell.
Right.
So I think that's really key. So my frustration within Black Hollywood is that there's not enough consensus where the people who have the real power from a financial resources point of view to really create entities in which distribution is sorted out, mm-hmm. financing is sorting out. I mean, Charles King is doing a lot of that in terms of being able to finance in-house and not depend on. I mean, it's a good model, but I would like for it to go a bit further.
Right.
And where we're not only looking at the United States, but we're looking at the world in terms of not only creating the content, but the content should be distributed around the world. Because contrary to what a lot of Hollywood says mm-hmm. about African-American content, it does, in fact, travel.
Yeah.
It can mm-hmm. travel.
Oh, yeah.
It's just that when there are not buyers who are, you know, sensitive to the fact that the world really does appreciate Black content,
mm-hmm.
and that given the opportunity, you know, like a Moonlight or Black
right,
Panther
right.
or, you know, some of the notable films like Us as well, when you produce them and you get the establishment behind it, see what happens. Those numbers go up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you can't say to me Black doesn't travel, because when you do it, it does very, very well,
right.
even more successful than North America.
Right.
So if we can't rely on others to create that for us, because it's not happening, right?
Yeah.
We have to do it ourselves. And it's not enough to have, you know, hashtag Oscars so white, you know, because we're still limited in terms
mm-hmm.
of, you know, I call it crumbs, and maybe that's going to hurt me for saying that, but, you know, I don't believe in having crumbs. I want the cake.
There you go. Give me the whole cake.
The whole cake.
Just briefly touch on what you're doing in South Africa, because that whole building is amazing.
Did you get to see it?
No, I didn't.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I sent you a video.
Yeah, please send me a video.
No, you have it.
Oh, did you send me?
I think I sent it to
okay,
you.
Okay, I have to definitely take
it's,
a look.
Yeah, it's
I'm
going to
post it.
So it's just the rendering of the studios that the studio
yeah.
we're building. So we're building the South Coast Film Studios in the southern coast of South Africa,
mm-hmm.
About an hour outside of Durban.
Mm-hmm.
It's a $100 million project, so
it's
massive. So we basically want to be the Warner Brothers of Africa,
yeah.
right? So in South Africa, it's the most sophisticated
right.
film and television industry of all of the nations in Africa.
Wow.
And it's the only country that offers subsidies. So where films are financed through the government.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really typical in Europe and in other places in South America where films are not just financed through equity or investment, private equity or studio money.
Right.
So our model is that we participate in co-productions where we have partners in other countries that can access subsidies from their particular country to put together a movie.
Mm.
So I'll give you an example. We're making the Blue Mauritius, mm-hmm. the Anthony Mackie film in South Africa, you know, on a almost $15 million budget.
Okay.
But the equity that we have in there is probably about $1.5 million. The rest is subsidized because we're doing this as a German, French, South African co-production. And most black folks don't know that is possible.
That's
that
great.
You can make money. Make films from government subsidies.
Mm.
So you know how farmers get subsidized in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Filmmakers get subsidies in the rest of the world and in South Africa. And so it's a very attractive place to do business. So a lot of Hollywood productions, film and television, Europe shoots a lot of films there.
Wow.
And so there's only two film studios, one in Johannesburg and one in Cape Town, and that's still enough sound stages to accommodate the amount of film productions and television productions that are being shot there. So we had this idea 3 years ago to build a movie studio.
Wow.
And we now have 54 acres of land overlooking the Indian Ocean and this sort of state-of-the-art film and television studios, which is magnificent, to be honest with you.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. We're going to stay tuned for that for sure. Well, we're running out of time, but first, I just want to ask you real quick, what's your favorite film that came out this year so far, James? And Dexter, you can think about it.
I mean,
I got one.
Dexter's ready. Let's go to Dexter.
So it was not this year.
Okay.
It was nominated for an Academy Award, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's Queen film.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
That was a great one. That was a great one.
Watching that movie.
I mean, this year I'll go with Us.
Us? Okay. Yeah. All right.
2019.
Yeah, I mean, you cheated, but it's okay.
No worries. I don't even know if I've seen any movies in 2019.
Been busy.
No, I watch movies. They're always on the plane. I'm always watching movies on airplanes.
That's very true. Well, thank you so much, guys, for joining me. It's been awesome having you inside the studio. Thank you for watching. If you're tuning in, thank you to AfterBuzz TV and Black Hollywood Live for allowing us to be here in studio doing our thing every Thursday. Go ahead and tell everyone where they can find you on social media or what have you.
At James Few, all lowercase.
At James Few, and
so it's at D Street MG. That's my Twitter. That's it.
D Street MG. All right. Yeah. Sounds good. Thank you again, gentlemen.
Thank you, Danny.
Thank you for tuning in. You can find me everywhere at I Am Danny Royce. We'll see you next week. Same place, same time inside the Black Actor Studio. Bye, guys.
On behalf of our BHL staff, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Check out our Black Hollywood Live YouTube page for even more great programming and amazing content. And be sure to subscribe and like our channel when you do. I'm your BHL host, Nakia Monet, and you can find me on all social media at Kiki Boom Boom or at Black Hollywood Live. Black Hollywood Live, Hollywood redefined.